Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 20. And if you haven't been turning to 1 Samuel with us the past 18 weeks, it's pretty close to the beginning. You're only about an eighth of the way through the Bible there. 1 Samuel chapter 20. Last time, David had several narrow escapes. Saul was trying to kill him, and now he is on the run from the law. So this is 1 Samuel chapter 20. I'm going to read the whole chapter for us, and then we'll go back and dive deeper. Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life?" "Never," Jonathan replied. "You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes." And he has said to himself, "Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." So David said, "Look, tomorrow is the new moon festival, and I'm supposed to dine with the king. But let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he says, 'Very well,' then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, then you can be sure that he is determined to harm me. As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I'm guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father?" "Never, David," Jonathan said. "If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you?" David asked, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" "Come," Jonathan said, "let's go out into the field." So they went there together. Then Jonathan said to David, "By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away safely. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my father, even when the Lord cuts off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon festival. You'll be missed because your seat will be empty. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began, and wait by the stone easel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it, as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to him, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here,' then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you're safe. There's no danger. But if I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then you must go, because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever." So David hid in the field, and when the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought, "Something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he's unclean." But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go, because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' That is why he has not come to the king's table." Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On the second day of the month, he did not eat, because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, "Run and find the arrows I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" Then he shouted, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing of all this, only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go carry them back to town." After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. When you think about the all-time greatest examples of friendship, where does your mind turn? Maybe the Lone Ranger and Tonto, we were talking about them a few weeks ago. Or maybe Maverick and Goose, anybody go there? Frodo and Sam, anybody? Maybe when you think of the greatest friendship of all time, you think of a best friend that you've got right now. And if you do, you are blessed. Maybe you think of a friend that you had when you were younger, that you look back and say, that was the best friend I ever had. What makes a friendship like that? You listen to each other, right? You look out for each other. You feel encouraged just by being around each other. You kiss each other, don't you? You bow down to the ground to each other. No, probably not the last two. But that's what Jonathan and David did to express some things that still make friendships what they are. When you think of examples of friendship in the Bible, Jonathan and David rise to the top as the most compelling, best known, most talked about friendship in the Bible. And for good reason. They're committed to each other. There's a mutual warmth of affection and service that we can aspire to. But it's also about more than just one friend to another, because Jonathan recognizes David as the king that God has chosen, his king. Now, I want to make sure by the end of this series that we all know what the word Messiah means. So can somebody shout it out? What the word Messiah is, a Hebrew word. What does it literally mean? Anointed. Okay, anointed means you pour oil on something. Like when the prophet Samuel came to David and poured oil on his head. And that was a sign that God chose him to be what? Somebody help me out. King. Right? So let's say it together. Okay, Messiah literally means anointed. And it's a sign that God chose him to be the
king.
Good. One more time. I know it's kind of feels like elementary school, but this is how we learn stuff. Messiah means
anointed.
To be the
king.
Good. So when Jonathan approaches David, it's not just as a friend. It's as his future king, handpicked by God. So this chapter is not just about relationships with our friends, but also our relationship with our king. Now, who's our king? Jesus. When we say Jesus is the Messiah, we mean that he's that anointed one chosen by God to be the king. He's not only here to save us, he's also here to rule over us. For bonus points, what's the name that we call Jesus that means the same as Messiah but in Greek? Christ. So Messiah is Hebrew, Christ is Greek, but they both mean the anointed one. So when we call Jesus, Jesus Christ, we mean that he's Jesus the anointed one, Jesus the king. Now, what does it look like to live in relationship with Jesus as our king? Jonathan can teach us a lot about that too. And it's all because Jonathan's life, like David's, was driven by zeal and love for God. So we're going to look at this remarkable friendship in the Bible, and the message that I want us to come away with is this. In zeal for God, dive deep into loving fidelity to Christ and to each other. In zeal for God, dive deep into loving fidelity to Christ and each other. So in the first place, Jonathan approaches David as a friend, and he teaches us loving fidelity for one another. And that's the first thing that we see in Jonathan and David, is loving fidelity for one another. And when I say loving fidelity, I mean two things, love and fidelity. It's a relationship that's both committed to one another's well-being and also warm affection for one another. It's not just a sort of person that, like, well, yeah, we get along fine, but, you know, in a pinch, I'm splitting, I'm taking care of myself. It's faithful, it's loyal. It's like the Marine motto, Semper Fi, always fidelity. On the other hand, it's not just business either. It's not just like, well, I signed a contract, so I have to take care of this person. You want to take care of them because you actually care about them. It's loving fidelity. And you can see this all over Jonathan and David's friendship. They're committed to each other's well-being, and they're very clear about that. They make what's called a covenant. It's this spoken agreement that they're going to look out for each other. So verse 14, Jonathan says to David, "Show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. They made this agreement. You show kindness to me and my family, and I'll be faithful to you. And they actually made this agreement in the last chapter, this covenant. And David calls Jonathan to keep that back in verse 8 when he says, "Show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord." Remember that covenant that we made to be kind to one another? I need that right now. This word kindness is one of the key attributes of God. It means not just a single act of kindness, but a commitment to kindness. Well, verse 14 translates unfailing kindness or covenant love. When Jonathan and David make this covenant with each other, it's this clearly spoken promise. No matter what happens, they're committed to being kind to one another. So when you have to fill out one of those forms that asks for an emergency contact, who do you put down there? Who's your emergency contact person? By the way, did you tell them that they're your emergency contact person? That's the kind of like the idea that we're talking about, this commitment to one another's well-being. They've agreed to be that person to drop everything and come to your aid if you're in an emergency. When Alyssa was in labor with Eva, it was the middle of the night, and I'm driving her to the hospital, but we've got two kids still in bed, so what are we going to do with them? We called Dawn Steffes. Middle of the night or not, we called her to come over and stay with the kids while we went to the hospital to have Eva. What's more, we knew that she was that kind of friend. We didn't have any reservations about asking her to come over in the middle of the night because we needed her, and we knew that she'd be there. Who do you have like that? Who is committed to doing you good, and you both know it? Are you that person to somebody else? Are you that person that somebody else knows, if I'm in trouble, I can call them day or night, and they're going to come help me? You don't actually necessarily have to have spoken that agreement. You've just done it so many times that you just know that you're going to be there for each other. But again, this is not just like a treaty like NATO where you band together for military support. Verse 17 says they made this covenant out of love for him because he loved him as he loved himself. Loving fidelity. There's this genuine affection between them. When it all comes out that David's going to have to skip town and run for his life, it says they kissed each other and wept together. Now, this whole kissing each other thing might weird us out a little bit. May make some people wonder, did they have some kind of like homosexual relationship going on? And of course the answer is no, it wasn't a sexual relationship, though it does teach us a little bit about what a good marriage ought to look like. So Pastor Tim Keller talks about marriage as both affectionate and committed, right? There's a warmth, there's a feeling side to it, and there's also a legal commitment side to it. On the one hand, you don't want to just be roommates or coworkers. There should be warmth with your spouse. And if it's not there, you can build it. You can work to develop that affection by spending time and sharing your thoughts together. But also, marriage isn't just governed by feelings either. If people get divorced because they just don't like each other anymore, they just don't feel in love anymore, That's an insult to God's design for marriage. If you're not getting along with each other, work at it. You can work on that marriage. Without that lifelong commitment to each other's good, for better or for worse, then it's not really a marriage. It's just like a long-term dating relationship on record with the Secretary of State. Marriage is a lifelong commitment to each other's good and warmth of affection. Now, of course, that's not what Jonathan and David had exactly. This is not the first example of a same-sex marriage. Our culture is, in fact, impoverished when they can't look at a deep, intimate relationship and go anywhere other than a sexual direction. If we think that a warm, committed relationship like Jonathan and David had to be sexual, then we've got a shallow view of friendship, not a biblical view. Rebecca McLaughlin wrote this great little book, Secular Creed. Isn't that nice? I mean, you could read that in a day. And she takes on the LGBT claim that love is love, and people of the same sex have just as much right to a sexual relationship as people of the opposite sex, instead of being, you know, just friends. And Rebecca McLaughlin basically says, what's wrong with being just friends? We desperately need meaningful friendships. Non-sexual, but same-sex relationships that are personal, that are deep, that are meaningful and committed. Now, we don't necessarily have to kiss each other. Please, I'm just going to throw it out there. Please do not come up and kiss me. If you're an exception to that, you know who you are. Brothers did that in those days. You know, like Jacob and Esau kissed each other. Joseph and his brothers kissed each other. It was a brother thing. But we do need to be able to express affection. We need to be able to express hugs or handshakes or even fist bumps. You know, a fist bump is an expression of affection. It's a warm thing. And we want to be able to share our frustrations, sometimes even our tears, with each other. If you're not a tearful kind of person, that's fine. But you got to be a person that can tolerate it when your friend is. We need good, deep, same-sex friendships without being afraid that somebody else is going to perceive us as gay. We need to be able to have those relationships. Loving fidelity, both affection and commitment. And they take effort, but they're worth it. And one more attribute that makes David and Jonathan's relationship richer than many relationships today is mutual submission. Every good relationship requires us to put aside what we want in order to think about what somebody else wants. Sometimes that also means putting somebody else's thoughts and judgments before our own. Submitting to each other requires humility and trust. And watch how Jonathan and David do this with each other. Look back at verse 1 again. So David's fleeing for his life. He comes to Jonathan and says, what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life? Now notice, there's humility in this question. I mean, he can say, I don't see anything wrong that I've done, but that doesn't mean I'm convinced that I haven't done anything wrong. I trust your judgment more than I trust my own. Can you see anything in me that I've done wrong? Notice how humble that is, to be able to ask somebody whether you've done something wrong. Is it fair to say that most fights are the result of assuming that I'm right and the other person's wrong, whether that's at church or in your marriage or at work? They shouldn't have said that. They shouldn't have done that to me. Fights get resolved when we're willing to say, I wonder if I was wrong. I want to understand their perspective to see where I need to change my thoughts and behaviors. And Jonathan shows the same kind of humility toward David. So verse 2, never, Jonathan replied, you're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so. Notice how Jonathan totally disagrees with David. He doesn't believe that his father's trying to kill him, and yet he's willing to trust David's perspective enough to do it his way. So verse 3, look what happens when David explains his perspective. David took an oath. Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there's only one step between me and death. So Jonathan said to David, whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you. Look, I don't think my father's trying to kill you, but I'm going to take your perspective seriously enough that I'm going to do it your way. even though that's not how I see it. Always insisting on doing it your way is not the mark of a good leader or a strong person. It's the mark of an arrogant person that doesn't know how to have mutually respectful relationships. Our marriages, our work relationships, our church depend on us being able to put aside what we think, what we want, to treat each other with humility and mutual submission. But underneath it all, underneath the affection and the commitment and the mutual submission, there's what gives strength to these bonds is that third person in this relationship. There's a third person between Jonathan and David. Verse 8, David says, "You have brought me into a covenant with you before the Lord." Again, verse 12, "By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father." 13, "May the Lord deal with me severely if I do not let you know and send you away safely." 14, "Show me the steadfast love of the Lord." On and on it goes. Their conversation is just laced with this recognition that there's a third person in this relationship. Their friendship is built on their love for God. That's where the affection comes from, that shared love for God. That's where the commitment comes from, this submission to God's character. That's where the mutual submission comes from. That humility towards each other is based on their surrender to God's will for both of them. And this is not a side point. This is the foundation of the whole thing. Now, I just heard Jeff Rodifer saying the other day that, you know, a house may look okay, but if the foundation's bad, it's not going to be okay for very long. The house is going to go down if the foundation's bad. God is the foundation of this friendship. And he's a foundation that doesn't move or crack. That's why the church can be this body that crosses political lines and racial lines and national boundaries, because it's based on one Father that we all share, and he doesn't change. When we have nothing else in common, our commitment to God draws the church together. That's why a marriage can endure hardship and conflicts and not give up, because it's a covenant made with God. And that covenant doesn't change if God doesn't change. So Jonathan says to David in verse 23 and again in 42, "The Lord is between you and me." He says it twice. The Lord is between you and me. He's the glue. He's the foundation. He's the one that holds us together. Your marriage is ultimately about God. It's not just about making you happy or making your spouse happy or even raising kids. The main point of your marriage is to glorify God by reflecting his love in a visible way. But having that primary commitment to God actually will make you and your spouse happier than you would have been if it were all about you. The church, obviously, I hope it's obvious. I hope it's obvious that the church is ultimately about God. Every one of your relationships is ultimately about God because your life is about God. And it makes you better. It makes your relationships stronger than they could possibly be if it were just about you or just the other person. Because God is the strong foundation. He makes your marriage, your friendships, your relationships with your family stronger. You'll be a better friend, better spouse, better member of this congregation if you can see God as the purpose and foundation holding it all together. And if that's true of our earthly relationships, even more so, God is the center of our loving fidelity to Christ as king. So Jonathan doesn't just approach David as a friend, but as his future king. Again, Messiah means what? Anointed to be the king. This is what Jonathan's father Saul cannot understand. He can't imagine. He thinks that somebody would have to be brain dead to give up being the king to let somebody else be king. So when Jonathan insists on defending David, Saul basically starts cussing him out. Right? He says, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." I don't know what old English words we might use in our language, but that's pretty bad. "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established." This is an airtight argument to Saul. Like, obviously, if you let David live, then you can't be king. Therefore, obviously, we need to kill David. Duh. Saul would not be able to imagine in his wildest dreams the conversation that Jonathan had with David just 2 days earlier. Back to verse 14 again. Show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Jonathan, okay, listen, the son of the king, the heir to the throne, is begging David for his life. He's throwing himself at David's mercy. Why would the son of the king throw himself at David's mercy? Why not just bump him off? Because Jonathan is committed to David being king, not him. He's fully persuaded that God's going to bring this about. If David's kingship and Jonathan's kingship were like two warships, two battleships going to war, Jonathan would torpedo his own ship and get on David's ship. He says, you're king, not me. Now, was Jonathan just a coward? Was he really the son of a perverse and rebellious woman? No, he just understands that God's in control. And unlike his father, he actually likes it. He delights in God ruling over him. And so it doesn't even occur to him that he even has a claim to the throne. Like, it's not my throne. It's David's throne. God gave it to him. David is the Messiah, the anointed king. When we call Jesus the Messiah, when we call him Jesus Christ, he is the king that God has anointed to rule over us. Will you approach him like Saul or like Jonathan? Are you going to fight with Jesus for control of your life until the day that you die, like Saul did? Or will you approach him like Jonathan, actively surrender the rule of your life to promote the rule of God's chosen Messiah? Make your choice. When you wake up in the morning, do you think of all the things that you want? Or do you pray to dedicate your day to him? Let your name be hallowed. Let your kingdom come. Let your will be done in my life. Do you open up your Bible like a loyal subject receiving instructions from your king? Or do you have like a stack of messages piling up from your king unopened, saying, well, I'll just give it my best guess? Sometimes your loyalty to Christ is going to be in competition with loyalty to other people in your life. And this is tricky. You know, Jonathan has no intention to betray his father or to rebel against his father. Love for God makes us more faithful sons and daughters to our parents. You know, it's Mother's Day, right? Do something to honor your mother today. God commands it. And our commitment to God makes us better children to our mothers and to our fathers. But unfortunately, Saul has set himself against God's anointed king so firmly that he sabotaged his own son's ability to be faithful to him. And this is the part that really upsets Jonathan. Even when Saul throws a spear at him, tries to kill him, it says that Jonathan was angry. And we think, well, yeah, because your dad just tried to kill you. But no, that's not what he's upset about. It says because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. Now, we love our families, right? We love our friends. But when they treat Christ shamefully, when they choose to live in sin and get angry towards Christ and his word and his rule, it grieves us. Because we can't compromise our commitment to Christ to please them. We can't join them in sin. We can't join them in turning away from following Christ. We can't just tell them their sin is fine or their religious beliefs are fine for them. We're grieved because we want our first love for Christ to fuel and strengthen our second love for them. But they're walking away from Christ and we can't go with them. And Jonathan puts this choice starkly when he says, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. You hear what he's saying there? He says, be kind to us when the Lord cuts off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Now, Jonathan wants David to be exalted. He wants David's rule to be secure. He wants his enemies to be defeated. He just didn't want his father to be one of those enemies. And yet, whether Saul is willing to follow David or not, Jonathan prays, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And we know with confidence that Christ is going to rule over all nations. We celebrate that. We want Christ to be exalted. We want his kingdom to flourish. Yes, we even want his kingdoms to be cut off and defeated. But we don't want our family members and friends to be those enemies. That's not our choice. We can only choose to be faithful to Christ. And the point's not to be judgmental towards anybody. It's not to be hostile towards anybody. We know that we were God's enemies once before we came to faith in Christ. We were under God's judgment once. Again, Jonathan doesn't say, may the Lord call David's enemies to account because he hates his father or because he hates anybody else. Verse 17, he says this because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. And people that don't think of Jesus as a real person, think of him just as like this religious symbol, cannot understand this kind of love, where it grieves us for people to insult Jesus, to make fun of Jesus and reject him. They're not laughing at our religious beliefs. They're laughing at the one that we love more than we love our own lives. And we're not choosing religion over family. We're choosing a person named Jesus. And we love Jesus for a lot of the same reasons that Jonathan loved David, for his character, for his mutual commitment to God. We love Jesus because he's compassionate, because he healed the sick, because he touched the lepers and the outcasts, because he spoke the truth even when nobody would listen. We love Jesus because he loves the Father more than we possibly could, but that love that he has for the Father resonates with our love for the Father. But we also love Jesus for a reason that Jonathan didn't have. We love Jesus because he gave his life for us. I love thee because thou hast first loved me and purchased my pardon on Calvary's tree. And when you talk about loving fidelity, a commitment to being kind, nobody does it better than Jesus. Jesus came to earth, took on human flesh, knowing what it was going to cost him, but being committed to do kindness to us anyway. He invited us into that covenant relationship with the Father, not because he needed us, but because we needed him. Knowing that being faithful to that covenant was going to mean him laying down his life for us. That kind of loving fidelity from our King inspires us to love him with the same fidelity, even if the whole world, even if our own family is against him. If you've been holding back from following Jesus, you're not sure you want to commit. Know for certain that he is God's chosen king, and nobody will ever love you more. There's nobody that's going to be more committed to you. Pursue that relationship first in loving fidelity to Christ, our King. But we also need deep, Christ-centered friendships, including our marriages, but not only our marriages. We need deep, meaningful Christian relationships outside of our family. We need friends that share our love for God. And that mutual love for God feeds our love for each other. We need people that encourage us and will be there for us in the middle of the night when we need them. It's going to take some work, but it's worth it. Let's pray together. God, thank you for all the friendships that you've given us that reflect that kind of love. Thank you for people that maybe we can look back on in our lives that we say, wow, they were there for us. And there are friendships like that are too rare today. Give us the commitment, the conviction to pursue friendships like that built on Christ, where we'll be there for them no matter what, and we know that they'll be there for us too. But Lord, all that's built on what you've done for us, from your commitment to us. I pray that you'd plant the knowledge, the understanding, the grasp of that love for us deeply in our hearts so that it grows into a vibrant love for you and a deep commitment to Christ our King. Lord, we offer up our lives to you. Please work in us this morning. Please draw us to you and plant us firmly in that loving fidelity to Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.